Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Before the big interview begins, I want to remind you that we're now producing over 8 hours of advert-free podcasts every month for our socios at patreon.com/GrahamHunter. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. For just £2.99 per month, you get a weekly magazine show, extra socio-only big interviews, plus documentary specials. And when you sign up, you get instant access to the entire archive. So far, that's Rafa van der Vaart, Ledley King, and Robbie Keane waiting for you right now. Enjoy the show. Lights, camera, action. Not quite. This is a podcast after all. But part two of the big interview with Martin Compston, brilliant actor, will take us to the set of The Damned United, the film which told the story of Brian Clough's ill-fated spell in charge of Leeds. Martin, who plays striker John O'Hare in the film, is often fiercely critical of movies about football, but he explains why he thinks that The Damned United gets it so right. He also talks about what it was like to work with the director Ken Loach on another great film which had football as its backdrop, Tickets. From Loach to Michael Sheen to Miss Marple, Martin tells great stories about some famous names. And how about another? Prince? Martin's late night encounter with the legendary songwriter took place on the eve of a Soccer Aid match. And after partying like it was 1999, which I'm sure was the first time in his life he tried that, Martin still managed to turn in a Soccer Aid performance which earned him special praise from the special one. You've introduced the theme that we wanted to talk to you a little bit about, the Murray brothers, the Scots lacking this focus, winning mentality. I'd imagine that some of that mentality you have to be able to concentrate in a cave in Bucharest at 4 a.m, or whatever it might be in your work. And we'll talk about your work broadly, yeah. But you've been involved in a couple of football projects on film, which happily blends the narratives a little bit, including one that will be more famous and one that I think made a huge impact on us, Tickets. But let's start with Damned United.
Yeah.
What's the experience of filming that like? And did you even know who O'Hare was?
No, I knew of the team, but again, because I remember having a conversation, I'll bring it back to that. I had a conversation with Tom Hooper, the director, who went on to win an Oscar for The King's Speech right after Damned United. But I remember them saying to me, because the big thing, they were the most successful team of that era. And I went, no, they weren't. Celtic were the most successful team of that era. We won the European
there's
Cup.
There's a theme.
But it was great to be part of. For one reason, you had 14 actors in a hotel for 3 months.
So you could all help each other with your lines.
Yeah, we were
is that what we're saying?
Yeah,
there was some sort of improvisation classes.
Yeah, we were all there for each other, put it that way.
Uh-huh,
I remember, it was that
many. All times of day and night, is that?
I remember one day. I was, because we were hitting it that hard and we were training. And I remember.
Getting in character,
I had to put a chair behind my door because Stevie Graham, we'd all got keys cut for each other's room. So we could get, so if anybody was not wanting to go on a night out, we could go and get them out. But it was brilliant. And Michael Sheen's a phenomenal actor, lovely guy. Michael can play a bit. But it was nice to be in that, because some of the footage as well, I remember watching them do the scene with Colm Meaney and Michael Sheen, which was the interview between Clough and Revy when after Clough had just been sacked.
In the Yorkshire TV.
Yeah, he turned up.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, reading it, going, that's not believable. And they right away went, no, this happened. And he showed me, so I'd encourage anybody to watch it. And so Clough's just been sacked by Leeds United and he's been asked for an interview and he turns up the studio and Don Revy, the former manager and his mortal enemy, is there waiting on him and they have this bizarre interview to get out. And again, but Revy raises some good points. Why did Clough take that job? He labelled them dirty Leeds, which they're still to this day, I hear people calling them. And he tore them apart, but it was, I think, because people have this thing about me, and I actually just got offered a football film, which I turned down, because I hate football films. I don't think they're done any well, and when it's something you're so passionate about. What Damn United did great about there is all the inner workings of the club, and it's a fantastic true story, and there's a lot of footage, and it's just clips of the game. You can't really catch a game in full flow, I think, unless it's playing. And I won't name it, but it's, they've got a bit of money behind it, and I remember my agents and my managers send me and saying, you'll love this. And I went, no, if this isn't done right, and they called a striker a goal-getter.
No, thank you.
And from that moment, I went, no, if you can't even, I don't care who you are, if you can't do your research enough, even if you're not a kickball, to know that it's a striker, then you're not going to connect with your core audience. And I love football films in terms of films that are around football, but to actually capture the game playing. There was another film, actually, which was it was a fantastic true story about a lad in the Falcons who Boca Juniors signed, but it was all very political because they wanted to claim the boy for his own. And it was a great story, it was true, and then but the ending had the boy score one against the Argentinians and then run and beat his own whole team and score into his own goal. And I remember trying to explain this to my American managers, I go, why this is can't be possible. And, and the only way I could explain it, it's like throwing a touchdown into your own end zone. It doesn't happen. This can't happen. So I think football is something very hard to capture on film.
We asked a lot of the listeners to talk about this subject, to suggest football films that work. What were you all doing? Not one of you mentioned Gregory's Girl. Right. Possibly the greatest ever film, never mind football film. Keep up. But we came to the conclusion that very often American sport can be captured on film and has been quite well.
Yeah, but again, I think because because football in full flow, it's very easy to see somebody who can't play football.
Yeah.
You know, whereas like American football was just in its own way, it has so many stoppages. So to get in that huddle and stuff and see that throw.
Okay.
But then, I mean, there's great sport films. I mean, even like, you can tell White Man Can't Jump. Those two can play basketball. You can see that right from the off. In my mind, the only way you could capture a really good football film is to employ actors who could really play and then just let them play and get what you got.
At which point, the actuaries are going to say, but what if one of the stars turns an ankle? They're not going to allow it to happen. That's true, isn't it?
Yeah, you've got to let it happen. I mean, on Damned United, fucking Stevie... Well, we pal Stevie Graham, like a lot of people know him, so it was Al Capone and Boardwalk Empire, but Stevie's a great friend of mine. He absolutely scudded me on Damned United and won. You know, he was supposed to do it, but it was a great moment as well, actually, because Stevie was playing Billy Bremner. So we had a lot of local sort of younger lads in as sort of the extras and stuff. So we were playing training games, we were playing our positions to try and get in, and we're playing Derby versus Leeds. Stevie's running about the park, being a wee Scottish general, shouting abuse, and he's giving this one kid abuse. Is Billy Bremner, and the guy's dad ran on the pitch. Guy's like, leave him alone. And we're all like, whoa, he's Billy Bremner, what are you doing?
We're pretending.
Aye. And then I remember the dad going off, I saw you're a good actor, and Stevie going, I've got a few awards as well.
I've seen him, he's intensely funny. The way I've seen him off character, he's sucker AM. When he comes on, you've got that brilliant, even sitting as a viewer of the television, you're like, anything could happen here, literally.
He's great. He's great fun. He's great to be around. And he's one of those actors who's universally loved. And I mean, literally from DiCaprio, Depp, and down to sort of way where anybody's ever worked for him, he's everybody loves him. Everybody, I think Scorsese called him, he's British Joe Pesci. Yeah, he's well loved, yeah.
That's astounding.
Yeah, they worked together on Gangs of New York, and then I think Scorsese headhunted them for Al Capone and Boardwalk Empire, and because he's a talented boy.
Well played Stephen. Hopefully we'll talk later. Sheen captured that role like not many people can do if you're playing somebody real. He went and I think he did the same in Frost
Yeah. It's funny, he did Frost Nixon and he played Tony Blair. Mm. And Michael's one of these incredible actors where he's played three different historical characters there. Mm. And somehow, by the end of it, he looks like every one of them.
Mm.
And he doesn't, but physically, just because he kind of morphs into them. But there's a massive difference in acting between doing an impersonation and acting, because mm-hmm. that's for people like Rory Bremner and stuff to do. It's not mm-hmm. impersonation. No, you have to bring the character to life within their mannerisms and stuff. And I think Michael's the best in the business at it. Been lucky a couple of times with some of the bigger actors I've worked with, and I worked with Michael when I was quite young. There's a couple of scenes where he's in the dressing room giving us all this big team talk and rallying the troops. Now, obviously, that looks like maybe a minute, 2 minutes on film, but that's like 2 days film, because it's on Michael from multiple angles, and then you've got film around him, the rest of the team. And I remember the ADs and the directors and stuff saying, Michael, save your voice, because he's in every scene of the film. Like, let somebody read in for you. And Michael going, no, if the boys are reacting to me, they'll react to me. And when you're a young actor, seeing that coming through, that sort of sets a standard for you.
So it's a learning experience, because I'm not talking about you here, but generically, when you read about the industry, books particularly, you know, it's said to be a fairly envious industry, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's brilliant stories about, you know, who gets the best shot, taking a light, or that fascinates all of us. But you were able to watch and learn and admire,
Never stop learning. I mean, I did a Miss Marple a couple of years ago, and we knew Julia McKenzie, and it's probably the most I've ever learned from anything, because she's got this, I think it's 16 page denouement. This she's speaking for 16 pages. Now, I made the stupid mistake on the first day of standing. That was a learning curve as well, because every other bastard went in and sat down, and I went, well, I'll be the one standing at the fireplace. And you realise you're standing for 2 days solid. One old dear actually fell asleep during it. But yeah, it was great, because it kind of came to her.
That was very realistic snoring.
Because when it came to her, she kind of bounced up as if she hadn't been sleeping. But she was 2 pages late. Right? She just sort of bounced in. But because when you're doing that amount of pages, I'm going through it the night before, just going, right, how would I approach this? Try to learn it and go, right, well, that's kind of just information. That's information. I'll get to that. That's the meat of it. She made every single paragraph come alive.
Wow.
She committed to everything. And you're thinking, wow, if she's doing that at that age, then there's no excuse for me not to be doing it.
Good point. You've used the phrase about 16 pages. What we're talking about is script reading, script learning.
Yeah.
What does a script look like? To tell people who've never had a script in their hand, what does it look like? What instructions are there? Is it literally just black and white and no guidance?
It's just, they start black and white, but they call them the coloured pages. So there's mistakes, they're called pink pages. So you get the script will change and that comes in, and so it's new lines, and then it'll be yellow and then there's blue. And, you know, in Line of Duty, they become platinum. And you've just got this multicoloured rainbow script you're walking about with. Yeah, I mean, it's probably not too much away from just being books. It's just the stage directions, and obviously because it's being filmed, the scene has to be set, so it's like interior, exterior, time of day and stuff, so people can get a... Because it's not just for us. I mean, the people who are costume designers or who are locations or set designers, they need to know what the place looks like, so you have to set the scene every time and then before it cracks on. But, it's funny, these things. I mean, it's just, I've been doing it now nearly 15 years. It's just sort of, it's my bread and butter, you know.
When you talk about Line of Duty, you talk a great deal of pride, not just about the performance or the character, but about what the show stands for. And one of the emblematic things is the big long interview scenes.
Yeah.
You've given me to understand that the actors have got a voice in how that develops. And you, from the outside, you'd always imagine that the director's the boss.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, with something like, especially TV, but something like Line of Duty, basically you get two directors a year, sort of per block. So one does the first three episodes, one does the second three. But if somebody's, a director's coming on in the fourth series, and we've been doing it for 4 years, we know the characters inside out. More, you do need a fresh voice, and you need obviously somebody to kind of run the ship and control it. But we know how these things work. I mean, and the interview scenes are completely unique, you know, so... Lenny James in the first series actually set the standard. Lenny came in, and because with these sort of things, any time I've ever done scenes of that length before, you tend to break it up because people say they want to keep the momentum going, and by the time you get to page 4 or 5, you're tired or you lose your way. But that's what we want. That's what would happen in a real interview, you know. So if something goes a bit awry or you're a bit flat, then it gives the person on the other side of the table time to up their game or react. And so Lenny came in and he said, right, we're doing it all the way through. And we were all a bit shocked, but I mean, it's that sort of fear thing. Once we did it once, we went, well, that was great. Mm. Like, that really, really helped. And this, unfortunately, we didn't know the seasons were going to get longer and longer and longer as it went on. The final episode of series three, that was an extra, that was an hour and a half. Usually they're only an hour long. But if it was just a normal episode, that final episode was just two scenes. It was a 28-minute scene and a 30-minute scene around the table.
Shit.
Either daunting, but I mean, you feel you've earned your money that day. I mean, and as I say, like somebody like Tandy Newton, old superstar, you know, lovely woman, BAFTA winner. Mm-hmm. Even for somebody, we've got to reassure her going, it's all right, we'll get through this. Because the thing with the Line of Duty as well is it's not just the length. The dialogue is so challenging. You know, all this police talk, all this forensic speak, you know, exsanguination, genome sequencing, you know, all this kind of thing. And to make that sound like you're going after somebody, it's not the most threatening at times, but it really is if you're, it's in the real world, because these people know what you're talking about. Not to mention try to hold all that together with an accent. It's not easy. It's a tough day's work, but we've done something that was never really tried before. And I think that's why people have reacted to it so well, and we don't make any apologies for the audience. So you have to stay with it. And in this day and age, everything's so immediate, you know. It's binge watching us, but we make people hold on for the week, because you have to digest what's going on. You can't be checking your phone, you can't be tweeting or whatever in the middle of it, because if you miss something, it's gone.
So the idea is that you're giving depth, veracity, intensity. It's also because you're talking about the police procedures, long scripts, but you're also, each of you, the three principals, you're very intense people, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, depends if you meet in a bar or in the 12.
The characters are.
Yeah.
I'd imagine you use a lot of energy. Burn a lot of energy.
Well, especially I'll probably say this to lots of people, but Steve, who plays a wee tosser, you know, and I intentionally make him so. He's a little, you know, terrier running about in his waistcoat getting after people, especially in the last series. It's kind of maybe not something you would notice sort of off the bat watching, but we're always on the move, whether it be in the office. We're very rarely sitting still, because you want to keep this idea of movement and something going on. So when you're doing that, like scene after scene, day after, it gets a bit, because you just go, can we just sit down for one scene and just have a chat? But then when we do sit down and just kind of slow everything down, then you know it's something, usually something heavy is about to hit.
Bat this away if it's rubbish. Have you learned anything from sport that you take from a team environment, a dressing room environment, about performance?
Oh, absolutely.
Into the sort of...
I mean, I thought that from coming from football, I thought that quite immediately, especially jumping in that the kind of way I look at it. I mean, sort of the director's your manager, you know, and you, even if sometimes you don't agree with them, you work for them, you know, and you give them your best shot. And you quickly realise with these things, it is one big team, because I think where people lose their mind in this job is, for instance, it was pouring a rain the other day when we were filming, and somebody's following you about with an umbrella. That umbrella's not to keep you warm, it's to keep your costume dry.
Yeah.
But people can lose a sense of importance, you know, and they think, oh, I've got all this happening. And when people are running to make you tea, it's not because you're more important, it's because you're not allowed to leave set.
Mm-hmm.
So they always know where you are, and so you're ready to go. You know, but people can get, I think, they can get filled, and it's easily done.
What are you saying? That if everything's done for you all the time,
yep,
you get into a mode of thinking that everything should be done for you all the time.
Because it can't. But even for me, I mean, I'm very grounded, so I said I know all these things aren't done for me, Martin Compson. It's done to keep the actor on set and make sure he's ready to go and he's not drenched from one take to another. But it can be quite disconcerting when you go for 4 months of having your driver outside waiting on you and your shot picked up for you, and all of a sudden the job's done.
And there's nobody there.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, I said I'm quite grounded, but I can see it can mess with people. It really can.
I think it's one of the probably the worst faults of interviews, but I'm about to do it anyway because I'm curious about this. Sky used to, when I did reviews, I'd send you a car.
Yeah.
It would be a BMW.
Yeah.
I haven't lived your life. I haven't done anything like yours, but I remember thinking exactly the same. When you've got to find your way across London and there's not somebody doing it for you, or you've got to work out the tube or elbow and elbow with a tourist in it. It is a good jolt. It does teach you to get off your high horse yeah. and fucking do what you're supposed
well,
to
one
do.
One of the biggest ones they had for me, and it was they kind of blinded me, the bastards. I was doing reshoots for a bigger film, and I was filming Line of Duty in Belfast in the morning, so I was like, you're up at 6 or whatever, and you're there for 7. I was filming until 5, and they wanted me to do a night shoot in Czech Republic, so just go right through. Obviously, but I had to be on set, so I wrapped in 5 at Belfast, and I had to be on set at 8 in Czech Republic to then start filming. And so they've sent a private jet for me.
Hello.
And so, I mean, the excitement of that on its own was sort of like, you know, I mean, little boy, you know, kind of swaggering through the airport, and the lovely Sergio Garcia was just in front of me getting on. So you're thinking, I've arrived. And then so get the private jet over, your wee wait or whatever, and then go film all night. And so I haven't slept for 24 hours, and I didn't even think, so I just assumed the jet would be there waiting for me. Flight back was via Hamburg, Prague to Hamburg to somewhere else, to London, then to Glasgow. 4 flights.
That's not right. Now, what you've been saying about, like, keep the costume dry.
Yeah.
They should have been thinking,
no, they were,
keep the fella on his pins, flights.
They thought of that.
They thought,
because I was done. They thought of that. Get him there on the private jet so he comes happy. But once it's done, you don't need them anymore. Yeah, because we flew. I remember we drove by the private jet entrance, and I went to the guy. I went, "Where are we going, man?"
It's funny. This helps because Fletch has already said he played against you in the cup final. Yeah. Sergio Garcia never off the bonus. Do you know Martin Compson? I'm sure I saw him in that game.
I didn't have the balls to say hello to him. So I love the way. I mean, I'm so happy the way he won that eventually, because the Spaniards, him and Ballesteros, you know, I mean, my dad was a huge Seve fan.
Seve represents everything that we should be as Scots.
Yeah.
Well, what you Gallus think, well, and mad, but winning
we,
too.
I was a boy, and my pals, one of my best pals' dad, took us down to Prestwick for when the opens on, just to see the players coming in. And Jack Nicklaus, I mean, they must be busy, but we're kind of saying, he kind of just kind of swanned us off, and we kind of went to Seve, and people were grabbing him. And he kind of went as well, and me and my pal were just walking away, and then we just said, aye, turned around the car, and it's Seve, like, shouting us back to the car. And I've still got it on that, because we just got fish and chips, and we got beside the fish and chip wrapper. And I spilled fucking vinegar on it on the way back down the road, and I tried to switch my mates, and he caught me. But I've still got it in the house.
Kevin Bridges, your bus ticket story has just been trumped. Up your game. Seve Ballesteros on fish and chip paper.
Fish and chip paper, aye.
Only in Scotland.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We're not going to let you go, even though you're going to meet very important people. Much more importantly, hello Paul, hello Gordon, after this. Tickets?
Yes.
I'd like to hear about tickets.
Tickets was the second film with Ken Loach, and it was a kind of a mad, because I mean, Ken, I think, is only coming to sort of, he's, a lot of people love him here, and he's coming to Promise, one of the greats, but in Europe he's adored. You know, and so they had this big
because
film.
Of the prominence of art house, independent house cinema.
Independent cinema. That's a better way of putting it. And yeah, like in France, when you go to Cannes with them, I mean, it's mayhem. But so they had this idea of doing a film about refugees on a train was core, but then three different stories, and the three different directors did half hour each, and the last half hour was Ken's, and it was about three Celtic fans on their way from Glasgow to a Champions League game in Rome. Oh man, it was ideal. I mean, you were getting paid to run about in a Celtic strip and sing Celtic songs. And one of the boys, Gary Maitland, who's in it, he's a big Rangers man. He has lived it down to this day.
The best job he's ever had. Does Ken Loach, just as an aside, does the statements he make, the films he make, does he represent something, themes that you believe
absolutely.
In?
Absolutely. I mean, anybody kind of knows me knows I'm a socialist and kind of things I believe in. But I think what Ken does, one, he makes the films that nobody's got the balls to make. I mean, I, Daniel Blake, is one of the most important films of the last decade in my mind, but it's a commercial success. That's what Ken does. He brings these things out, and the way he films again is completely unique, which was quite tough to start because Ken never says action, he never uses mark. Well, mark for anybody is basically, you think all these camera angles are in perfect focus all the time, but basically you've got something on the floor that you need to hit every time for you to be in focus. So it's kind of, that's something from not going to drama school, which was great for me on Mark of the Glen, but you need to learn very quick. You need to hit your mark. That's your big thing. You just sort of, you kind of need to learn to see with your feet.
Yeah.
You know, you just need to gauge distances.
Because literally for people, it'll be taped maybe.
Yeah, it's tape or something, but sometimes not even, because if you can see the floor, you're not allowed. So
You
kind of know where it is and you've got to kind of just basically hit it. But Ken doesn't use them. Because he doesn't want people to be aware of who's on, because the focus of the scene will change with the focus of the camera. Mm-hmm. So you could think it's on you, but it might not. It might be on somebody else.
So is that technique supposed to be presenting a slice of life as if the camera
absolutely
wasn't there?
And it was very difficult. Exactly. It's sort of, in some ways, sort of like documentary. But what's great about that is, as you said, you don't know who's the focus of the scene at times. So you're giving your everything because people become very aware of when they're on camera and people want to know their angles, darling. Am I here? Am I here? Am I mid-shot? Yeah. Am I close shot? And then there's this kind of thing that maybe it's a bit older school now of people always saving themselves for the close-up because they think that's their big one. But sometimes the scene doesn't get into the close-up because it sits so well on a wide shot. But people are half-arsing it because they're waiting on it to come in. I mean, I've been guilty of it in the past. I think most actors have been at some time. But with Ken, as he doesn't shoot that way, you're never aware of what's what. So every single take you're given, it never says action, never says cut. So you're never aware really of, with anything else, you get the clapperboard, which I'm sure everybody knows is the thing at the front of the scene. But there can be a sense of, right, now, act. Mm-hmm. That's been done.
Yeah,
whereas
yeah.
with Ken, there's nothing like
that. So does the scene just peter out?
No, you kind of know what it's natural end, but he'll just pop in and go, oh, thank you, that kind of thing. You'll never see cut, you know, and there'll be nobody coming in, or they'll do that when you're not looking.
We're nearly out. There are two more subjects. One is brief. Sadly, before he died, the Prince phoned me and said, is it true that Martin Compson knows Greg, Gary Tank Commander, Nick Hugh? Is Gary's a bright, leading man, writer,
Greg,
performer. Greg to us. Is he the kind of guy who might lead you astray?
I think we lead each other astray quite a lot. He's a great friend of mine. I say a very, very talented boy, you know, with Fresh Meat, and he's doing the A Word now and stuff. But yeah, we sort of coax each other on, you know. We've ended up in some heaps together.
Is there an example?
Well, one of the great things about this job is I got to play in the soccer thing at Old Trafford, which was just an unbelievable experience. I believe Kevin Bridges touched on it on his, you know, and me and Kevin had a great time, you know, sitting with Mourinho and stuff. And well, basically, I played a charity game and I'd done my ligaments and I had a keyhole on it. And I kind of thought that was it. And it took me out of work for 3 months. So my agents said, right, enough's enough, sort of. Like, it's time to concentrate on your actual job. And then the call came through for Soccer Aid. And I hadn't even run or anything on it yet. And I was just thinking, maybe this isn't the right thing, but I'll go down and I'll have a run. And if I can wait on it, I can't miss this opportunity. Because they told me Mourinho was managing. You were going to be playing with Seedorf, Stam, Davids, Del Piero, Shevchenko. You know, it was an incredible lineup, Van der Sar. And I thought, I just need to kind of, just to be on a pitch with these people. And Mourinho was unbelievable. So we turn up on the night and I'd run about with the physio that day. And he said, look, it's weak, but we can do stuff for you and it'll be all right. We'll strap you up and all that kind of thing. So Mourinho comes down for the initial kind of dinner thing and he had the dossier on every one of us. And he says, look, I know about your knee. he says, you're going to start at the weekend. Because the point was, we were to train Tuesday to Friday and play the game on Sunday. And you were sort of to play yourself into his plans. And he said, you're going to start, don't train. Like, we need you. And a bit of me was like, you know, having been a footballer, I wanted to be on a training pitch with Mourinho and see the secrets and all that kind of thing. And so he kind of let me kind of pot about. He'd always kind of have me on and go, like, this is where you're going to be, front post, back post. He's so organised, it was unbelievable. Like, everybody knew where they had to be. And it was just mind-blowing to see this. And the first thing he said is, look, this is for charity. We're going to enjoy ourselves, but we're here to win. My teams don't lose. So we got the Tuesday, Wednesday, the Thursday. He'd let me have a little kick about it. He says, right, tomorrow, he says, I'm going to let you train on the Friday. So I was buzzing. So I was trying to get an early night. And then the phone goes and it's Greg. He says, look, you're going to come out. You want to come in town and meet me? I'm out with Paolo Nardini, who's another good friend. And he says, no, look, mate, I've been on the table all day, getting my massage and stuff. He says, the guy says, my knee's fine. I'm going to train tomorrow. And he said, look, just come into town. I'm like, no. I said, look, just come into town. Hung up, phone goes again. He says, look, just come meet us for a beer. You're all right. I said, look, mate, we're on lockdown. I'm playing this game on Sunday. And he said, he says, look, just move. I went, no. Phone goes again. It's Paolo. And he says, if you don't come out tonight, you'll regret it for the rest of your life. And I went, look, you take the piss here. Because I said, look, I really shouldn't be doing this. So do you mean that? And he says, just come down, you'll see what I mean. So I got out the back of the hotel and jumped a taxi. Now, all the England boys were already out, but I think they were about hanging, but Mourinho was kind of strict on us. Rightly so, I think. And so I got a car into the Groucho where we're sitting now, meet Greg and Paolo for a drink. And he says, look, just follow me. We walk round the corner, just round the corner there. I think it's the back of the Hippodrome. I walk into this tiny wee booth and out struts Prince. And proceeded to play for the next 5 hours or so solid.
No.
It was unbelievable. Obviously, you know who Prince is and you know some of the songs and stuff, but I've never seen anything like it. And there must have been about 100 people in the place.
Whoa.
And then so I got on about 7 or 8 in the morning. Jose gave me the shout, got on the pitch. And I went, no, I think you're right, Jose. I'm back on the table.
We twins.
Felt my knee a bit heavy and I don't want to risk it for Sunday. So I just sat and lay in the bed for the rest of the day again.
Did you tell him?
I told him after that. I told him on the Sunday night. But I didn't want to jeopardise because I think I was supposed to start left mid. Michael Sheen broke his wrist and Michael was supposed to start right back. And he said, look, I'm going to need to move you to right back. So, but I've got a great picture because of that, because he said, look, I'm going to move you to right back. So Michael's going to start and then we'll put you on. He's going to change the banners, whatever, and then you go on. And I've got a great picture framed of me at Old Trafford with Jose telling me at the side of the pitch pointing where to go. And then he said to me, Ollie Murs was one. He said, just make sure, he says, that boy's a whippet. So just make sure he doesn't get on the ball or do anything. And as he ran by, Jose just ran on the pitch and nailed him. Just nailed him. But you see, wee Murs rolling, looking up at me, and I'm mad. And then that set the tone for me, so I just nailed him the rest of the night. But it was, I mean, that kind of stuff was unbelievable. And to get a thing of being on the pitch with those players. And what I'll never forget is maybe he's on. To say he's underrated isn't the right word because he's won the European Cup with 3 different teams. But Seedorf controlled the tempo of that entire game. I mean, you've got world class players around him, all legends, but he controlled that game. When he wanted to up it, the whole game upped, and when he wanted to slow it down, I think he scored 3 that night. Actually, it was unbelievable.
He remains a really good athlete as well.
Him and Davies were whipping the bodies out in the showers. Me and Kevin made ourselves quite scarce. they are still man mountains. But I mean, I think it was 70,000 there that night, you know, and it was. And with a lot of these charity games, that's you feel like the one I'm playing on Sunday, it's charity, but that there was a lot of needle in that. There still is because the week of the build up, because then it's sort of England v. sort of Scotland, Wales and Ireland.
It was important, and you want to do yourself justice as well, even though you're out partying till late in the morning.
Because I remember as well, because Mourinho did say to me, he said, make sure he doesn't get a ball on him, and I think Ollie Murs got substituted and he ran down at the side of the pitch and shouted on me and I turned around and he just clapped. And I was just like, fucking hell, it was amazing. I remember as well, he told me, do not cross the halfway line. He says, let Clarence and Edgar do all the balls. He says, I want you to defend. We need you. He said, we've only got so many because it's a celeb football thing. I think you're only allowed 4 footballers on.
Yeah.
And he says, we need you to defend. And at one of the corners, Big Yap Stam, who doesn't head the ball, he headbutts a ball. It's unbelievable seeing how far this man puts a ball with his nut.
Yeah.
And the whole, when you hear Yap, place just parts. Nobody gets near him. But he shouted at one of the corners, Martin, get forward. And I just pointed at Jose, who ran down, and he wasn't even looking, just a wee wag of the finger, and yeah, went, all right. I was just, I mean,
you
stuff like
what that. You achieve professionally now, that's going to stay up there, top.
Every young fella's dream. I played Glasson through the past. That's the stuff that stays with you, because that's the stuff I grew up watching, you know. I mean, I always loved acting, I always loved movies and stuff. But, you know, I didn't dream about winning Oscars. I dreamed about lifting the cup with Celtic.
Now, we do have one question before we stop, because people bother to write in. So, Ian Hamilton, if Martin could play one famous sportsman, who would it be and why?
Benny Lynch.
It's a shout.
Benny Lynch. Because he's another one, I think, because it pretty much goes back to what we were saying. He achieved it. He was Scotland's first world champion. He went all the way. And I think, and Robert Carlyle has been a vocal backer of it, and so am I, to try and get a statue for him at Central Station. Because there's this incredible picture of him at Central Station. I think there's like 10,000 people there after he won the world title, and him being lifted and carried through crowds. But it was, I mean, it's a really tragic life story. He was undefeated. When he lost the title, he lost it because he was overweight. He never made the weight. He knocked the guy out still. And then he sort of descended into, you know, alcoholism and died destitute. But everybody said he gave pretty much every last penny he had away. You know, he was a very kind man. But no, he went all the way. So that would probably be something. I think that's a story that deserves.
Has that story been filmed?
I had one of these things. Maybe that's where it came to my problems. And it's one of these jobs. Script offers came through, which was too good to be true. And it turned out it was. It was me playing Benny Lynch and my coaches and managers was Gabriel Byrne, Brendan Gleeson, and Robert Duvall, I think. So it was just like, if this happens, and it sadly didn't.
Then the finish is this. That's a great choice, by the way. And the big enemy, if there's a campaign about Benny and the statue, we'll join.
Statue for Benny.
We'll join, we'll publicise. I agree with you. The last one is, how do you live in LA?
I don't, that's the problem. I'm on the verge of getting a divorce, I think, because my beautiful wife, I think since we've moved there for 2 years, I've maybe spent three months there. I've been on the road under no illusion how lucky I am at the minute and just going job to job, but your personal life goes when you're working. I mean, I've been married now just coming up for a year and we still haven't had a honeymoon, you know. And but again, the thing is with this job, a lot of it's to do with momentum. You know, and I'm on a great roll at the minute. You know, I went from filming Plain Sight about Peter Manuel. Within 3 days, I was in Belfast for 4 months. I had Christmas, and the 2nd of January, I was in Prague to do the film with Keira Knightley. Got home for a couple of weeks, and now I've been in York doing Queen Victoria. And then I finished that in 2 weeks, and I start in 3 weeks my next big film, which is going to be 3-4 months. So technically, that's where the wife and the dog is. And it's where my hammock is, and it's where my Billy McNeil gnome is.
Out in the garden?
Yep.
In LA somewhere,
yeah.
Up in Cahuenga Pass, or I don't know, there's a Billy McNeil gnome.
Yes.
In a garden.
There is indeed. Yeah, it's my little Lord and Legends. Yeah, my little. I'm an actor trying to make it the cutthroat world of garden gnomes.
It's brutal,
eh? Yeah.
Then I'll wait to get you to describe the LA set. I just think living in an iconic place where every corner you've seen on television or cinema.
From that point of view,
it's not the glamour I'm after.
Yeah, no, if you go, because, I mean, we live North Hollywood, just in the valley, so, I mean, you're 10 minutes from Universal and stuff. But I'd encourage people to go, if you're all out there, go to places like, which the Magic Castle is quite tough to get into. It's like a private members club for magicians, where Johnny Carson and stuff and Cary Grant were all members. That's the kind of place I love. And there's a beautiful old Italian restaurant, again, which is called Dantana's, but proper old Hollywood. That's the kind of place I love.
That's what because I read the old cinema books. I read, you know, Disconnect from the World. Yeah. I read crime fiction. It's usually a cop or a detective in LA. Yeah. So you hear all the names,
Mickey Cohen and all that. Yeah.
The parks, they talk about the traffic.
Yeah. Well, there's one, again, it's like, because we drive over the hill quite a lot, and there's one building my friend tells me, I'd love it if it's true, there's these two houses where on one side of the street was Houdini and one side of the street was Chaplin, and they've got a tunnel connecting underneath. Now, again, whether all this stuff is,
it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I know, it's mind-blowing. Yeah, and you see some of these houses and you see, I think it's Jerry Lewis who used to, our house, it's, I live next door to one of my close friends, Ross McCall, a brilliant actor, people probably know him from like Band of Brothers and Green Street and stuff, but a big football man. And so our house is sort of our little kind of bits divvied up into three houses, but when it was one, I think Jerry Lewis owned it. I like it now. Living in West Hollywood and stuff, it can be really soulless because it's so cutthroat.
Do you miss pavements?
No, I miss greenery. I miss greenery. That's what because it's all fake green, lush green. But I found what I did find was, this is no joke. There's a game on Friday night. There's some lovely lads who they're actually, one's a big Antonio and Ruben, so the wee Mexican lads who work in the cafe, same as two brilliant wee footballers. We've all kind of became pals through football, and we play a game on a Friday night. And it's funny because the wee Latino lads can play really well, and Brit lads, but the American lads, one of them was playing with a set of earphones in, which I could not get my head around.
That's LA.
Yeah, and then another one, literally, I haven't seen this since I was nine, picked his ball up and walked off the park.
No, it's my ball.
It's my ball.
I'm not playing.
Do you know why he did it as
well?
Stop
kicking me.
You know why he did it? No, because I thought he got kicked, and I turned around to my mate, I said, what's going on? Somebody hit a shot, and it hit him in the stomach. And because the guy didn't apologise, he said.
No.
Yeah. He never even got tackled. He just got hit with the ball. And he picked up his ball and walked off the park and left. And he was a grown man.
That's the reason I have to leave LA. Just, it's there.
It's unbelievable. But the wee Latin, the Latin lads can certainly play. But it's, you see guys kicking a ball up and they shout good yardage and you're thinking, what is going on here? You know, playing a long ball.
Go getter.
Yeah, there's a lot of sun. Put it that way.
I'm not against that myself. You're very generous. You've got a busy life. The momentum is talent. Thank you for sharing this. You're a great storyteller.
Thanks, mate.
It's been a pleasure. The big interview with Martin Compson. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this free podcast. I'm betting you did. If you want to hear more, not just these interviews, but weekly magazine shows and documentary specials, we'd all love you to become socios of The Big Interview. I promise you, I won't let you down. It's worth it. Go to patreon.com/GrahamHunter and join for just £2.99 per month. You'll get instant access to our entire archive of podcasts, plus 8 hours of new and advert-free content every single month. You'll also be helping us to produce more of these shows. Thank you for listening.